This is Free Speech Radio News, the weekly edition. I'm Nell Abram. On this week's show, President Obama says hundreds of U.S. military advisors will go to Iraq, but no troops will return to combat. Israel steps up military action in Gaza and the West Bank while tightening restrictions on Palestinian detainees. And local police departments test public reaction to domestic surveillance drones. All that and more on FSRN's weekly edition. Pressure is growing on Iraq's Prime Minister, Nouri al-Maliki, to step aside as Iraq's government faces an insurgency that has captured key territory within the country. The militant group known as ISIS launched a surprise offensive earlier this month and has since garnered the support of previously unaffiliated armed actors. Iraq's largest oil refinery has been a flashpoint for fighting between insurgents and pro-government forces. Which side is in control of the facility remains unclear, as does the fate of hundreds of its workers. U.S. President Barack Obama has stopped short of ordering the airstrike support the Iraqi government requested, but did authorize 300 military advisors to support its efforts to repeal insurgent advances.
I think we always have to guard against mission creep. So let me repeat what I've said in the past. American combat troops are not going to be fighting in Iraq again. We do not have the ability to simply solve this problem by sending in tens of thousands of troops and committing the kinds of blood and treasure that has already been expended in Iraq.
According to Iraq body count, almost 2,800 civilians have died since the beginning of June, and the United Nations says more than 1 million Iraqis have fled their homes this year. The alleged kidnapping of three teenaged Israeli settlers has sparked an increase in Israeli military actions in the Palestinian territories this week. Israeli soldiers shot dead at least two Palestinians in the West Bank Friday, including a 15-year-old boy. Israeli authorities also clamped down on Palestinian detainees in Israeli jails, where for nearly 2 months, more than 140 have been on hunger strike to demand that Israeli authorities either release them or bring them to trial. Dozens have been hospitalized and are facing the threat of force feedings. FSRN's Rami Al-Maghari has more.
Outside the offices of the International Committee of the Red Cross in Gaza City, Misbah Abid Rabbu, the 58-year-old father of a detainee, has laid fasting on a bed for the past 6 weeks. Misbah's son, Raji, has been in Israeli detention for more than 4 years.
A prisoner of war is one taken from a combat tank, not one taken from his or her home. When the Israelis came to our neighborhood of Abed Rabo, they vandalized the whole area, including bulldozing homes and trees, quite similar to an earthquake or like a tsunami.
In 2009, during the Israeli attack on the territory known as Kaslid, Misbah's son was arrested, charged with helping Palestinian resistance fighters, and sentenced to 5 years in prison. This week, Israeli authorities tightened the conditions of confinement for Palestinian detainees. The move follows last week's disappearance of a three Israeli settler youth in Hebron City. According to the West Bank's Mandela Institution for the Defense of Palestinian Detainees, the Israeli army has stormed a number of West Bank areas and rounded up more than 200 Palestinians in the crackdown. Nearly 50 of those were rearrested, having been released from jail in a 2011 Egypt-mediated swap deal between Hamas and Israel that freed more than 1,000 detainees from Israeli prisons in return for the release of Gilad Shalit, an Israeli soldier captured in Gaza in a cross-border attack in 2006. Buthaina Dukmak is the director of the Mandela Institution.
Israeli authorities have now deprived detainees of access to TVs, newspapers, some foods, as well as the right to family visits for 1 week. Israel also imposed a collective punishment on the entire Gaza Strip. All this happens even though no one has yet claimed responsibility for capturing the missing settlers.
Israel accuses the Islamist Hamas party of kidnapping the three missing settlers, though neither Hamas nor any Palestinian group has claimed responsibility. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called the matter a serious incident that will have grave consequences. The Israeli military has also stepped up activity in Gaza, with airstrikes damaging several public facilities, including 10 schools. Ziad Thabit is Deputy Education Minister in Gaza.
The ministry calls on all international organizations and human rights groups to take a firm stance towards Israeli attacks against our school children and schools. These attacks are in clear violation of all humanitarian and international norms.
Israel says the attacks came in response to rocket fire from Gaza. The latest spate of military action also targeted several training camps belonging to Hamas and other armed groups in Gaza, such as the Nasser Salah al-Din Brigade. Local political analysts suggest that the latest Israeli crackdown, along with Israeli political campaigning against Hamas, aims to undermine the recent unity deal between the Islamist Hamas, which Israel calls terrorist, and Fatah Party of Western-backed Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. Rami Al-Mighari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
Unmanned aerial vehicles, or drones, have been patrolling U.S. borders for years. But their potential use by local law enforcement has raised questions about the trade-off between cost-effective policing and citizens' constitutional right to privacy. Earlier this month, the Los Angeles Police Department received a pair of Dragonflyer X6 UAVs from the Seattle Police Department, which had purchased them using federal grants. The LAPD says the drones will only be used for tactical events like manhunts and standoffs. But if LA's response is similar to Seattle's, those UAVs could end up as white elephants. FSRN's Larry Buell has more from Los Angeles.
As police departments around the country consider adding aerial surveillance technology to their toolkits, civil liberties advocates and some citizens want assurance the technology won't be used to spy on citizens suspected of no wrongdoing.
We're going to thoroughly vet the public's opinions on the use of aerial surveillance platforms by the Los Angeles Police Department before they are ever deployed.
That's LAPD Chief Charlie Beck deflecting criticism of the department's two new drones.
The Los Angeles Police Department will never, ever give up public confidence for a piece of police equipment.
Beck prefers the euphemism unmanned aerial vehicles to avoid the association between the department's new surveillance aircraft and the weaponized systems used abroad by the military and the CIA. The LAPD drones look like toy helicopters. They have a 10-minute battery life and can hover no more than 400 feet from the ground, and they carry sophisticated cameras. The Seattle Police Department bought the mini drones in 2012, using $80,000 in federal grants. But when residents learned about the program, there was pushback, and the Seattle PD mothballed the devices until the LAPD agreed to take them. Angelenos have a good reason to question how and when the UAVs will be used. In 2012, the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department tested a surveillance camera mounted on a Cessna plane and flew it over the city of Compton, capturing high-resolution video of everything in a 10-square-mile area. There was uproar from the Compton citizens and community leaders when they learned about the test long after the fact. Doug Honig, a spokesman for the ACLU of Washington State, says his concern is not just the capability of today's UAVs, but how more advanced drone technology could be used and abused in the future.
They're going to have things like high-powered zoom lenses. They'll be able to use thermal imaging. They'll potentially be able to use radar to look through the walls of homes and businesses. They'll use facial recognition software. All these things potentially will be available to domestic drones, and they're going to be cheaper because the research is going into it, and the nation's largest aerospace manufacturers are very interested in developing the domestic drone market.
The solution, Honig says, is to rigorously vet the technology and put formal guidelines and restrictions on it right now. Seattle residents pushed back on the police drone program after the information about it came out. Privacy advocates say public dialogue needs to begin well before police departments invest in the technology. And some privacy advocates say electronic police surveillance without a warrant is never acceptable.
Well, if a police department says we are going to go through our own vetting process and we are going to be very careful before we spy on someone, what they are saying is we are going to violate the Constitution, but trust us.
That's author and activist David Swanson. He was instrumental in drafting a resolution last year in his hometown of Charlottesville, Virginia, that called for a 2-year moratorium on any kind of drone use. Since then, 8 other U.S. cities have followed Charlottesville's lead. Swanson admits that some of the resolutions are symbolic only, but the public engagement and dialogue that helped create them is important.
When you put a camera up in the sky and videotape everything that's happening on the ground below, which is what these things do, you are not going to a court and getting a warrant describing what you're searching for and when and from whom and on what grounds, and then conducting that narrow search. You are conducting a widespread search of everybody.
Privacy isn't the only concern about police drones. Safety has come under question after a couple of police drone crashes in Texas. The Federal Aviation Administration allows law enforcement to send up drones in urgent situations, like search and rescue operations, as long as they have a special certificate of authorization. But it doesn't require operators to have any special license or any skills. The FAA's $63 billion next-gen upgrade is supposed to address safety issues. NextGen promises to modernize air traffic control systems and allow for remotely piloted aircraft in civilian airspace, but draft regulations have not yet been made public. For now, little is stopping local police departments from buying and using UAVs as they please, until and unless citizens learn about it and push back. Larry Buell, FSRN, Los Angeles.
A surge in unaccompanied minors apprehended by Border Patrol agents during the past few months has prompted federal authorities to improvise shelters to hold the children while their legal status is determined. Most of the children are from Central America, and a large percentage of them were picked up in the lower Rio Grande Valley of Texas. Officials at Lackland Air Force and Army Base in San Antonio have transformed some facilities there to hold as many as 1,800 immigrant children. Other minors in federal custody have been moved to so-called national placement centers. FSRN's Shannon Young spoke with Border Action Network Executive Director Juanita Molina, who recently visited a placement center in Nogales, Arizona.
First, why are we seeing such a huge spike in apprehensions of unaccompanied minors at the border? Is it the result of a specific event, or is it caused by an accumulation of factors?
I think that we've seen these kinds of waves of migration, and I think that for people who aren't necessarily as involved in the border movement, this may feel sudden or seem sudden, but the reality is that there are many reputable academic institutions that have been doing studies about this and predicting this pattern years before. We see everything from the United Nations to the Association of Catholic Bishops. The Jesuits have been tracking these migration patterns, and what we know is that the escalating violence and the diminishing economies of these countries in Central America are creating very dangerous situations for its people. And so that's why we see such a huge influx of unaccompanied minors, in particular young men between the ages of 12 and 17. Many of these children are being told that either they need to join the cartel or be killed by the cartel. And so that's why we see such a large influx of certain populations within the category of unaccompanied minors.
And unaccompanied minors aren't supposed to be held in immigration detention, at least not for extended periods of time. But now the federal government is expanding the infrastructure of facilities in which to hold them and transferring them long distances from where they were taken into custody. Why?
What we're seeing now is a different, you know, set of motion for the federal government. Now that Obama has declared this a humanitarian, you know, disaster, we're seeing different mechanisms come into place. And so one of them is the conversion of different federal properties into national placement centers. And so these theoretically are supposed to be temporary placements. when children are apprehended by CBP, they are essentially put into custody for 48 to 72 hours and then released to the Office of Refugee Resettlement or also to HHS. And so essentially, they're only supposed to be in this kind of a temporary custody for a very brief period of time. But since there's been such a huge influx, it's created a backlog in placements for these children. And so that's where we're seeing the overcrowding, the extension of time, and facilities that aren't necessarily equipped to care for children.
What's now the average length of time that these children are being held in custody?
Now we're looking at an average of about 14 days that these children will be in these centers. And, you know, in the reality of these children's everyday life in these centers, are their physical needs taken care of? And I can only speak to the Nogales facility and, you know, my close working relationship with CBP in the Tucson sector. And what I can tell you, it's not overcrowded conditions. It's relatively clean. The CBP is doing everything possible to provide for these children's physical needs. But unfortunately, they're unable to provide for the children's emotional and spiritual needs, and that's particularly apparent with the youngest children. Because, you know, this is a very disorienting environment. And I think the other piece that people don't always understand about what these children are dealing with is many of them have been traumatized. Children have been raped. Children have been beaten. Children have been in extreme situations and very fearful situations. And so you have children who are going to exhibit, you know, depression. They're going to exhibit increased startle responses. And so being in a detention facility is not the best place to care for these children.
If you could make some concrete recommendations to the federal government regarding how best to deal with this situation, what would you say?
Not to recreate the wheel. There are so many organizations that have dealt with these issues on global levels, and I just hope that the United States rises to the challenge in following the outline and recommendations that exist from the Children on the Run report from the United Nations, and to really embrace those comments and implement them in our systems.
That was Juanita Molina of the Border Action Network joining us by phone from Tucson, Arizona. I'm Shannon Young.
In Baltimore, Latino and African-American high school students have been in the news during the past few weeks regarding growing racial tensions between the two groups. The population of Latino immigrants in Baltimore has grown dramatically over the past two decades, changing the demographic makeup of areas that were once traditionally African-American and white. Dolores M. Bernal reports.
The rhythmic sound of cumbias goes hand in hand with the colorful tropical decor of the Latin Palace, a two-story nightclub in Baltimore's Phelps Point neighborhood. Enrique Rivadeneira is the club's owner. He immigrated to Baltimore from South America over 20 years ago. In that time, he's seen periods of racial tension come and go.
Lo que sucedía hace muchos años atrás está regresando nuevamente a...
What happened many years ago is returning again. Those things that we thought had to a point ended, that period of time. Now again, we see that something is out of balance with regards to the treatment that business owners and people of our culture receive.
Rivadeneira has been following local news about tensions among Latino immigrants and African Americans in Baltimore area high schools. The tensions have parents, school administrators, and city officials worried. Latino immigrant parents say their children are constant victims of assaults and robberies allegedly committed by African Americans. Anabel Dominguez is a Mexican immigrant whose son attends a high school in Baltimore.
They steal their cell phones, their money. They wait for them outside of the schools and they are assaulted. Finally, some Latino students had had enough and set up a confrontation to fight them. The school called the police.
Assaults against Latino immigrant students in Baltimore eventually led to the death of 15-year-old Oscar Torres in late May. Vigils were held by community members and activist organizations calling for an end to the violence. One organization that is attempting to bridge the divide between the two communities is Casa de Maryland, an immigrant advocacy organization. CASA community activist Zoraida Moreira-Smith says separation created by language barriers and cultural differences have contributed to the tensions in Baltimore, even though both groups share similar socioeconomic conditions.
I grew up in South Carolina, and I've lived in New Jersey, and now I live in Maryland, and each state has their own issues, and you do see the separations between the communities, but I do see that there is a trend towards uniting the communities more and more and more, especially when you see top organizations like CASA de Maryland joining other organizations, other African-American organizations in unity, coming out together, saying we need to work together.
One of the ways CASA is working to unite the Latino immigrant and local African American communities is with a program called Black Love, Brown Pride, which highlights the group's shared circumstances while celebrating the diversity in their cultures.
I don't know too much about the Latino community myself. You know?
Keisha Smith, no relation to Moreira Smith, is an African American parent whose son, Derek, attends high school in Baltimore and participates in the Black Love, Brown Pride meetings.
It's been great, actually. Derek has learned a lot about the different culture, the foods, and he talks about it when he gets home. He has nothing but positive things to say.
Two youth African American groups have joined CASA to help forge good relationships between immigrant youth and the Black community. Moreira Smith of CASA says that across the country, racial tensions between new immigrants and other groups is a real issue, which can be overcome by focusing on shared interests and creating a common ground through dialogue.
You know, as our youth are starting to grow up here and really being united and combined with all the communities, you do see them working together to deal with these bigger issues around violence, around housing, around families and children, because they realize, like, we're no different from each other. We're one community, and there's no reason to be separated.
Since the tension started, police presence at the high school has increased, and school administrators have held meetings with parents and students to de-escalate the situation. The school is also hiring more English as a second language teachers to better serve immigrant students.
The jobs are so limited. There's an animosity that has developed between the African American and the Latino community to some degree.
Reverend Courtly C.D. Witherspoon is the president of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. He says the violence stems from a buildup of frustrations over the lack of opportunities in the city for low-income people of all races.
But the reality is that City Hall is giving big tax breaks to developers, and job creation is not happening. And interestingly enough, that's an issue where African Americans and Latinos could work together side by side.
Members of CASA de Maryland have said that the new mayor of Baltimore, Stephanie Rawlings Blake, an African American, has taken a profound interest on the issue. However, concrete steps or an articulated plan to address the racial tensions have yet to materialize. Dolores M. Bernal, FSRN, Baltimore.
Of the 2.5 million Americans in prison, only a small percentage are women. Yet females convicted of crimes are jailed at a higher rate than men are, and most are charged for nonviolent offenses related to the war on drugs. Female prisoners face a different set of challenges than their male counterparts. More are custodial parents, they face higher rates of mental illness, and inmate-on-inmate violence by females is more frequent. A group of women who were held at the federal prison in Danbury, Connecticut, are organizing a rally in Washington, D.C. on June 21st to draw attention to these women and to call for changes in the criminal justice system. Melinda Tuhus reports.
In 1980, 13,000 women were in state and federal prisons. But as a result of the drug war and tough-on-crime legislation that included the end of parole and the introduction of mandatory minimum sentences, there are now more than 100,000. And if you add those in local jails, it's 200,000. Andrea James was one of them. A former lawyer, she served 2 years in Danbury Federal Prison for wire fraud. She started the group Families for Justice as Healing with a few other inmates in 2010, and now, on the outside, serves as its director. That group is spearheading the Free Her rally.
And it was organized with the focus being on formerly incarcerated women, using their voice. So although we reached out to organizations, quite a few of them that have supported us and that are coming to stand with us, our focus, our speakers, what we have to say is coming from formerly incarcerated women on behalf of the women that we left behind.
Many women have been caught up in the war on drugs, sometimes as active participants and sometimes as unwitting accomplices of the men in their lives who are drug dealers. Mark Maurer is with the Sentencing Project, which studies incarceration trends.
Much of the increase for women, even more so than for men, tracks along with the war on drugs and the stepped-up pace of arrests and prosecution. So today, about one of every four women in prison is incarcerated for drug offense. For men, the figure is about one of every six.
Beatrice Codiani, who served 15 years in Danbury on a racketeering conviction related to her membership in the Latin Kings gang, said women in prison have issues that men don't, like the fact that many of them are custodial, often single, mothers. Federal data from the Department of Justice shows that 62% of women in state prisons and 56% of women in federal prisons have children under 18.
I also think that because men get a lot of the attention in the war on drugs and the, everything about mass incarceration, and women are kind of, they don't really talk about women. So this was a good way for the movement to bring attention to the number of women who are behind bars. As women, we need to stand strong for our sisters.
Codiani was released in 2009 and works as managing editor of Reentry Central, a website that offers news and resources for professionals working in the fields of reentry and criminal justice reform across the country. Rally organizer Andrea James thinks incarcerated women deserve compassion, especially mothers who are separated from their children, but knows many people judge them harshly.
If you can't feel, you know, the compassion for the women that we're talking about, think of what it must be like for children who were with their mothers one day, and then their mothers are just extracted from their lives for these unconscionably long periods of time, and what that results in terms of the well-being of these children.
Meanwhile, the cost in money and suffering is huge. In 2010, states spent almost $50 billion operating prisons. States also paid additional expenses for mental health, child welfare, medical and economic support services for the children of incarcerated parents, children who use these services at higher rates than do other children. Recent studies show that children suffer long-term emotional damage when separated from their imprisoned parents. James says the rally has three goals: to raise awareness of the increase in incarceration of women and its impact on our children and our communities, to encourage President Obama to commute the sentences of women serving nonviolent drug offenses in the federal system, and to support legislation to reduce the use of mandatory minimum sentences and take another step toward equalizing penalties for crack and powder cocaine for those already incarcerated for cocaine offenses. Another legislative goal is support for an amendment to restore federal parole, which was eliminated when mandatory minimums were introduced to the federal system. Melinda Tuhus, FSRN.
And that's it for today's program. FSRN is supported by the radio stations that carry our show and by listeners like you. For transcripts, audio, and photographs from the stories featured on today's program and more, please visit our website at fsrn.org. Technical support comes from Lewis Reining at WTJU in Charlottesville, Virginia. Editorial services are provided by Shannon Young in Oaxaca, Mexico. From Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram. Thanks for listening.